So I thought that we would take advantage of the fact that we have no bar bat mitzvah this morning, that we're early and we have a smaller crowd, to have a discussion that I want to lead off with a few remarks. Since this is Shabbat Shuvah, you may or may not know, by the way, that Shabbat Shuvah was one of two Shabbatot during the year, traditionally, when the rabbi would give a very, very long talk. It's really true. One was Shabbat HaGadol, the great Sabbath right before Pesach, when you had to explain all the laws of Pesach. And the other, and that's one of the explanations, by the way, for why it was called Shabbat HaGadol, the great Sabbath, because great can also mean long, which is kind of the opposite of great. But the other was Shabbat Shuvah, when you had to give a long discourse on the meaning and the practice of teshuvah, of repentance. So in order to substitute for that, because we have the tradition of having those discourses not only every week, but also especially on the high holidays. So instead, it seemed to me that a discussion might be better, but I want to launch it with just a couple of remarks. One about two different kinds of tshuva, because our sources speak about two different kinds of tshuva. They speak about many, many kinds, obviously, but two different kinds of tshuva in a certain way in particular. And in order to illuminate, to explain what these two kinds of tshuva are, I think it would probably be helpful to pick a sin. So, but I would like to pick a sin that nobody here is involved in, so that nobody will think that I'm pointing at them. So, like, raise your hand if you've ever forged art. Good. I thought that was probably a safe one. So let's say that your sin is that you copy great masterpieces of art and sell them as though, in fact, you're Rembrandt. Okay, that's your sin. Please feel free at any moment to stop me if you remember that, in fact, you've done that. But I figure that one is pretty safe. I could have done gossip, but then we'd all raise our hands, except those of us who were lying. So let's say that's your sin. So every time you walk into a museum, you have an eye for which pieces of art you could forge or what styles you could copy, even if you wouldn't forge that exact piece of art, what styles you could copy that could be sold as a Rembrandt. Which, by the way, raises its own interesting question. That is, if you buy a piece of art that gives you as much pleasure as a Rembrandt, if you think it's as beautiful as a Rembrandt, but it turns out not to be a Rembrandt, why should that matter? Which is kind of an interesting thing. I mean, the piece of art is the same, it's just that it doesn't come from the person you thought it came from. But that's a separate question. I just thought I'd mention that to think of after Yom Kippur. So here's the two different kinds of tshuva. Let's say you want to do tshuva, you no longer want to forge art. But you know every time you go into a museum, you can't help, because it's like being an addict. Every time you go into a museum, you can't help but look at the art as though it is something that you want to imitate. Okay? So the rabbis say there are two different ways of doing tshuva. The lesser tshuva is never go into a museum. Because you know if you do, it's going to lead you, or at least tempt you, to do something wrong, and therefore you avoid it. And that is a lesser but a perfectly acceptable mode of tshuva. That is, if you've done something sinful, you never put yourself in the position again that you could commit the sin. Okay? Maybe you get rid of all the art materials in your house. Maybe you never pick up a paintbrush again, because you know that if you do, you're going to end up doing something you shouldn't do. Now, you've already guessed, I'm guessing if your mind is moving ahead, the next mode of tshuva, which is to change yourself so much that I could put you in a museum with a paintbrush and you still wouldn't copy the painting in front of you. And those are two different modes of tshuva. Let's say there's someone in your life that you always treat badly. So do you just eliminate that person from your life because, in fact, you just don't like them? You just don't like to deal with them, and you just can't be nice? Or do you somehow undergo some sort of process of self-refinement to the point where you can actually deal with that person and do it in a reasonable way? Now, you understand that some sins you have to change because there are many human situations that you can't get yourself out of, right? If, for example, the sin is gossip, well, you're not going to say, therefore, I will no longer know anything about anyone. You can't do that. So, in fact, you have to try to practice it in a different way. But there are many sins for which we could remove ourselves, but that, of course, is giving in to the idea that we're too weak to be able to change ourselves. So the first question that I want to ask, which is sort of inherent in tshuva, is how much confidence do you have in the genuine possibility for human beings to change? And I don't mean change in superficial ways. I mean change in fundamental ways. That is, can you really be different from what you are? I'm curious. I would like to start off, if you don't mind, with a vote. How many people think that people can fundamentally change? And how many people think they can't? Okay. If I was Mayor Villaraigosa right now, the lesson, by the way, that I learned from that whole debacle, which is a lesson that I share with you, although it's not a good lesson to share on Shabbat Shuvah, is if you ever want to cheat, cheat quickly. Don't cheat slowly. Cheating slowly is very bad. You have to cheat quickly. If you're going to cut the cards, cut the cards. Don't let anybody see you do it or do it three times. But actually, it seemed to me that more people said that people can't fundamentally change than that people can fundamentally change, which I want you to know, even though, if you want to, we can stop for a second and have everybody come in and take a seat. Why not? Come on in. We'll stop for a second. Come take a seat. Be comfortable. Right. That's a fundamental change right there. Usually we help people in the back. See? And it's done. Thank you, Artie. And we're all finished. Thank you, and let's move on to Aunt Galerina. So, I want you to know that even though it is certainly true that there's a lot of evidence for the idea that people can't fundamentally change, it really does go against the Jewish approach and the Jewish idea of the season, which is that fundamental change among human beings is possible. It's very difficult. I was thinking about the fact, for example, and then I'll take comments on this if someone wants to comment, but I was thinking about fasting on Yom Kippur. Do you want to know how different fasting is on Yom Kippur now than it used to be? It's very easy. If I told you, honest to God, if I told you literally that tomorrow the judge was going to decide if you would live or you would die, believe me, you wouldn't be hungry today. I mean, if you really took it literally, I said tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., you'd be at the courthouse and the judge is going to say you live or you die, you wouldn't want to eat today. You'd have no appetite. And the fact that we find it difficult to fast on Yom Kippur already, you realize, is a change from the sense of the awesomeness of that day, because if you literally believe on that day it's getting decided, you know, who wants a steak? So when we talk about change, realize that for our ancestors, Yom Kippur, changing on Yom Kippur was a change through a tremendous experience of anxiety and upheaval and all of that in a way that's not for us, right? For us, Yom Kippur is a lot about other things: how we dress, where we sit, whom we see, whether we park, all those things which didn't actually come into the calculations in old times, which is why when you read accounts of people come on Yom Kippur in synagogues, in not only in olden times, but 100 years ago, 150 years ago, people wept and they cried and they screamed and they beat their chests and all of that because they really felt as though their fate was being decided. Okay, so let me hear from somebody who thinks people can't change. Tell me why. Yes,
child
professor.
Child abusers.
Child abusers, okay. The rate, for example, although, well, I just want to say child abusers, where the recidivism, the relapse rate is astonishingly, dispiritingly high for people who do terrible, terrible things. Having said that, though, doesn't mean that people can't change. It may mean that there are certain syndromes in people that are ingrained. But does that make you think that, therefore, all people can't change just because child abusers don't? Okay. So somebody who thinks that people in general can't change, not just a certain class, but people in general. Okay, Erwin?
Political affiliation.
You don't think political affiliation changes over one's lifetime? Oh, I do. Very. How many of you have political beliefs that are different from your political beliefs as a child? As they say in the philosophy classes, QED, which means it is proved. So you grow and change, right? Now, you may not be able to change. It is probably true that you couldn't change your political affiliation now on a whim, but you probably don't want to. But what about traits that you really want to change? For example, let's take something that's not as radical as child abuse. Let's say you're somebody who has a bad temper. Not a horrendous temper, you don't, you know, shoot people when they offend you, but you have a bad temper. Sorry, I was catching up on Breaking Bad. So, how many of you think that such a person can change? Or tell me, let's argue for the inability to change. How many of you think such a person can't change? Okay, so when you say people can't change, it really depends what trait and over how long. So if that's true, then on Yom Kippur, realize that what we're trying to change are generally not radically, I mean, you're generally not saying, I've been a serial killer and I don't want to be anymore. Although, God willing, you know, all serial killers should come, not here, but somewhere to Shul. I could have done that. I went for Art Forger, but I'm guessing there are no serial killers in the congregation either. But most of the sins are, of course, more everyday sins, where change doesn't necessarily mean that you'll never do it again, right? Rechilut, which is telling bad stories about people. So yes, you do vidui, you confess. Does it mean that the tradition expects that you will never, ever tell another bad story about somebody? Obviously, that's not the expectation for most people. Right? Most people are going to. There may be a few who don't, but most people will. The expectation is that you'll do a little bit better. Roz, I'll get to you in 1 second. I just want to tell you something that I read this morning in Iturei Torah. One rabbi says, why is it that on all the Al-Chets, we only say once, Yetzer Hara, for the sin we commit with the evil inclination? He says, after all, isn't that the source of all sin? So why do we name it once? He says, because most of the time when we sin, we think we're doing it for good. So part of the tshuva on Yom Kippur is awareness. And awareness can help you change just because you can say, oh, I thought you liked it when I did that. But if you don't, then I'll stop. Yeah, Roz. I can't hear you, sorry. I still can't hear you. I think, why don't you stand up and say it? Okay, so Roz said that the point of waking up every morning is that you have the potential to change, and we're all works in progress. We're not set in our ways, although there's certainly, I think that's true, there certainly are fundamental human traits that are very difficult to alter. The people have to work very, very hard to change. Yes? Well, I don't know if those two are different. So let me say it to everybody, that circumstances are what make you change. It's not that you necessarily change, but you conform to new circumstances. But maybe that's what change means. Maybe, for example, The person who says, I don't know, well, think of it this way. One of the ways that you improve your behavior is by surrounding yourself with people who expect you to be good. If you surround yourself with people who expect you to be at your worst, you're likely to be at your worst. So you do change, but you change because of your circumstance. But to some extent, we choose our circumstance, right? I mean, for example, because you chose to come here this morning, you're thinking about whether people change. So, yes, you have an experience that you wouldn't have had if you didn't come here, but you did choose to come here. So, yes, when you choose your circumstance, it makes a difference.
Also depends on how much you want to change and willpower.
Yes, tremendous. The desire to change is, that's why, you know, that's why they say that change happens on the edge of anxiety. That is, when you really, when it hits you, when you're really uncomfortable, when you're anxious, when you feel like you'll lose something that you don't, or you have lost something, or there's something that you really want to gain, the chance of change becomes much greater. Yeah.
What about levels of change?
Levels of change, right. It's true. You could tell one less bad story this year, and that's a change. Now, honestly, incremental change. You can't, right, nobody, it's very rare for somebody to walk into a phone booth and come out Superman, right? It happens in comic books, but not in life. But small changes, remember what, and then I'll take a comment, remember what Franz Rosenzweig used to say. He said, Franz Rosenzweig was a great Jewish philosopher of the early 20th century. He said, when someone asks you if you do a certain mitzvah, don't say no. If you don't, presuming you don't, right? Instead, you should say, not yet. He said, but you have to mean it. You know, you can't go around saying, not yet, not yet, not yet, and not do anything. But his point was that change doesn't come just like that. Change is, in fact, for most of us, most of the time, a laborious, bit-by-bit, Sisyphean, you know, rock up the hill. Yes?
Selfishness.
Selfishness. What about selfishness? It can't be changed. Well, it depends what you mean by selfishness. If by selfishness you mean that you do things that make you feel good, yes, I think inevitably people will. But what makes you feel good can be changed. And therefore it's not, if it makes you feel good to give to other people, that's not selfish. It's not. Just because it makes me feel good is not necessarily selfish. So selfishness takes a lot of different forms. We don't call it selfish if what makes you feel good is kindness. Yeah. Yes.
Because we have to go in there believing that this day and this week, everything we're thinking and doing, there's a possibility of change. That's why we're doing it.
That's exactly, in fact, the rock bottom point is that the entire tradition, Yom Kippur, but not only Yom Kippur, is based on the assumption that human beings can change. All the Torah says, do this and don't do that. But if you don't think you can change, you may as well throw up your hands and say, I can't do this and only that. And in fact, Yom Kippur is certainly based on that. So yes and then yes, hold on one second. So unless you believe you can change, you're right. There's no point of Yom Kippur. Therefore, it's important to be convinced that you'll change because I want you all in synagogue on Yom Kippur. Yeah. Beautiful. So yes, we can change, but the reason we don't is because we don't recognize our shortcomings. We always have a rationalization. The reason I did it is, as my friend Joseph Telushkin says, rationalization is more important than food. Because he said you've gone an entire day without eating, but you've never gone a whole day without a rationalization. Doesn't matter, something, there's a reason why I did it, you don't understand, if only, and in fact, that's true, that's how we defend ourselves from change. I don't have to change because I did it for a good reason. And part of Yom Kippur is obviously, the whole point of the shofar is to wake us up to the reality that, okay, now, here's what I want to know. Here's what I want to know. And you don't have to tell me, I just want to know for yourself. How many of you that just disapprove of the fact that the cell phone went off, have had a cell phone go off in shul, in synagogue before? I mean, don't raise your hand. And that's a good example of rationalization. That is things that we do ourselves, and we know we've done it. When someone else does the exact same thing, we get upset at them, even though we don't get upset at ourselves. I mean, we get embarrassed, but we don't get upset at ourselves. And my best example, and then I'll take the comment, my best example is this happens all the time with driving. Right? We get so angry at people who cut in front of us, or who go too fast or too slow or God knows what, but have we done, or who are texting while they're driving, right? You see it in the window next to you and you go, oh my God, that's terrible. But have you done it? Well, of course you have. And yet, somehow, when we do it, it's not terrible. But when someone else does it, it's like the cell phone going off in synagogue, which is, I can't believe that they would do that. Yes?
Your original proposition to the congregation was, can people fundamentally change, which presupposes their fundamental nature, good or evil.
Their fundamental nature, what?
The people's fundamental nature. I assume from the conversation, because I'm now confused, that you meant good or evil. Can people who are evil become good? Or can people who are good become evil? We've now switched to people change habits.
Well, habits are a big part of being good or evil. Anger is a big part of being good or evil, right? Blaming other people for things you do yourself. So I wasn't thinking of this is an evil person, can they become a good person? I assume most people are mixed. The question is, can you change certain fundamental characteristics about you which may manifest themselves in habits but are still characteristics? So my guess is, by the way, it is a habit, for example, to disapprove when somebody does something that you don't like. Not everybody does that. Right? I know, for example, is this being recorded? Let me use my parents as an example, okay? One parent, I won't say who, because they both, God bless them, I mean, my father's no longer alive, but God bless them, they're both wonderful people in their way. But one of them, when someone would, for example, walk into synagogue dressed inappropriately, it would be as though you put a knife in her heart. But I'm not going to tell you who. But the other one of my parents, he wasn't a disapprover by nature. He would see it, he would say something like, you know, I thought that somebody would tell them that this dress is appropriate and that isn't, but would it kill him? No. So, there are like deep habits that come out in things like disapproval, but they're also strains of character. And so, and by the way, this also goes to another issue, which is that the thing that you have to fight with is not necessarily the thing that your neighbor has to fight with. You may not have the disapproval gene, okay, but you might have the one that tends to be allied to the non-disapproval gene, which is the indifference gene. People who disapprove also tend to care. People who say, it's fine, tend not to care. And sometimes that's not good. So it's never so easy that you can just say, I don't do that, so I'm off the hook. Because we've all got something, we may not be art forgers, if you weren't here at the beginning, trust me, that fits, but we've all got something, or many somethings, right? Some more, some less. I'm not putting everybody on exactly the same level, but we've all got stuff. Okay, let's take a couple more comments and then we'll wrap it up. Yeah, Jerry.
We're talking a lot here about...
Why don't you stand up so it'll be easier to hear you. Right.
And I think this is parallels with how we confess to people in the community. Can't do it alone. We need to help each other.
Right. That is a great point. Judaism really does. You know, there's therapies called systems therapies that doesn't believe that you can change one person in isolation. Everybody's like a mobile. When you touch one, right, everything else goes in a different direction. And that certainly is a very Jewish approach, because Judaism is almost all of your prayers are in the plural, right? Not all of them, but almost all of them are in the plural. The idea being, in fact, that nobody is isolated. Everybody is in a network of relationships, and you have to address the network in order to change the individual. Let me just get two people who haven't spoken yet. One, two. Go ahead. It's just the other person calling back. It's okay. Yeah. You really think that worry is more difficult than anger, or worry is more difficult than disapproval? I think worry is just one more deep trait of certain people that other people don't have. It is difficult to change, but so ask somebody who gets angry all the time if that's easy to change. Yes.
I don't think it's like a personality.
Yeah. No, I'm not sure that people can change letters either. But I would say that what we call a type A personality is a whole constellation of characteristics, and that you may not be able to change. I think we're talking more. If you do this, I mean, that's why the al-chets are pretty specific, right? If you do this, don't do it anymore, at least don't do it as much. But you're right, I think it is extremely rare to see a full-scale, you know, pupa to butterfly transformation in human beings. Yeah.
I think your body can't change for 10 years, no matter what.
Yes. Okay, so yes, well, one of the things that we didn't talk about, but which is true, is that we're not disembodied spirits, and when your body changes, you change too, and when your life experience changes, you change. But the question is, to some extent, how much you can direct that change, not necessarily of your body, but of the way your spirit reacts to it. Let me just close by telling you this. There's a famous phrase in the Talmud that is repeated all the time in works on tshuva, on repentance, and so on, that says, where a repentant sinner stands, even a tzaddik gamur, which means a completely righteous person, cannot stand. In other words, a repentant sinner stands higher than a completely righteous person. Okay? Now, as you might expect, that's a problematic statement for some of the rabbis. Because a completely righteous person is, you know, a completely righteous person. So how could a repentant sinner stand higher? So Rabbi Bunim of Psicho, who was one of the great Hasidic masters, said that's because there's no such thing as a completely righteous person. There are only people who think they are completely righteous. He said, and a repentant sinner is somebody who actually has insight into their own sin, and a completely righteous person is someone who is oblivious of what it is that they do wrong. So may we all be repentant sinners. Shabbat shalom.